Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Thanks for joining us here today in the Storycraft Cafe. We have an amazing show for you today. Kate Golden stops by the show again. She joined us on episode 124 about 6 months ago, and we talked about her journey from indie publishing to traditional publishing. And now her second book in the series is out, and we catch up on what this transition has been like for her and how this has affected her writing and her career. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to episode 124, or just scroll back in your podcast app, find episode 124. If you haven't listened to that one, listen to that show with Kate Golden, then jump into this one. Such a great conversation. You're going to love it. Thanks as always to Dabble for making this podcast possible. Here we go. And we are live in the Storycraft Cafe. I am Hank Garner, your host. Today, I am super excited to welcome Kate Golden back to the show. She was with us, I believe it was October. Right around the publication date of the first book of the Sacred Stones series. And that book was A Dawn of Onyx. Today, we're here to talk about the second book, which is A Promise of Peridot. And we have it here on the shelf in the advanced reader copy that I got from Kate's wonderful publisher. And this is book two in the series. If you have not listened to the first episode that we put out, go back and listen to it. We'll link it up where you can hear all about Kate's story of going from indie publishing success to signing a contract with a major publisher, and you re-releasing that book, and now two follow-ups. I think the last time we talked, the third book, the title had not been released yet, but I think we were just days away. Yes. I think it has been now. Yes. So now we have book two coming out about a month from now, and then book three will be coming out later this fall. Do I have that right, Kate?
Yeah. Oh my God. The number of facts you have, I'm so impressed. Yes. October 8th, A Rain of Rose comes out, which is the third book.
A Rain of Rose. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Kate, you have taken the publishing world by storm with this book series. How does it, you know, when we talked last time, we were just like a day away. I can't remember if it had just published or was going to publish in another day. Regardless, you hadn't had time to kind of soak in everything and see how it was being received. But I think it's safe to say that you found an expanded readership with the republishing of A Dawn of Onyx. How's it going? How are you feeling?
Oh my gosh. So grateful. Crazy grateful. It has been, I don't know, when people say, oh, it's a whirlwind, I'm like, what does that mean? But that is really how it feels. It's been, it's moved so quickly, that, you know, when A Dawn of Onyx came out in October, I was, just in the final stages, like proofreading and copy editing this book, A Promise of Peridot, and I was writing the first draft of the third book and promoting, you know, both, but it's just been so much so quickly. But I feel really grateful that, yeah, like you said, new people, new readers who had not heard of the indie published version were able to discover this book just in time for the rest of them to come out this year. And like the response has been so incredible, and the publishing team at Berkeley are made up of my favorite humans in the world. So I feel really, really excited, really grateful.
That's great. I had a fun question that I wanted to ask you, and this may have particular significance to you with the journey that you've just been on or in the middle of. Have you ever gotten a piece of writing or maybe publishing advice? Maybe you want to think of it in that way, that either turned out to be so amazing that you're just so happy you got this piece of advice and you hold it dear to your heart and you cherish it, or a piece of advice that was so terrible that you're happy you didn't take it, or maybe wish you would not have taken. Or sometimes people have one of each, but
okay, that's a really good question. I mean, the best advice that I ever got, I don't even know where I got it. I'm sure it was in some you know, adage, some book on reading. I feel like it might have been in Brandon Sanderson's YouTube. You know, I don't know if I'm sure somebody has or you've watched, or someone who's been on this podcast talked about it, but you know, he has a whole class that he did at Brigham Young University on YouTube about writing. But talking about like writing what you love, write the thing that you would read. Don't try to chase the market, but write the thing that you would be most excited to, you know, crack open the book. Right. That's the best advice. I stand by that, you know, 100%, because when I wrote this book, when I wrote this series, every time I've had a scene that, you know, was giving me pause or struggle, writing the thing that I was most excited about, most passionate about, the book that I would have wanted to read, has led me to I think my strongest writing and the scenes or books that people most respond to. And trying to chase something that I thought someone might want, or what the market maybe have told, would be telling me, you know, has never served me well. So I would say that's, you know, that's the advice that has worked very well for me, and that I would encourage anybody else who wants to write or wants to pursue, you know, a traditional or indie publishing career to do. Advice that was really wrong or backwards. It's such an interesting question. I wish I had like a killer answer, but I think the closest to it would be, you know, I think someone said, don't say yes to the first meeting, when I was just starting to meet with agents and just starting to meet with publishers. And they were like, you know, I think this was maybe directed specifically to me, but they were like, you're excitable, you love everybody, you're just going to get in and be like, it's perfect. Don't do that. You know, really be shrewd and make your pros and cons list and sleep on it. And maybe that would be good advice, but it just so happens that the first agent I met with and the first publisher I met with, they were the greatest meetings, and they were the people that I went with. And I would say I put a tally in the column for trust your gut. And if you immediately feel that spark, that's rare and special, and, you know, follow your heart.
Yeah. Talking about the first thing that you said about writing what you love and not necessarily chasing the market, you just happened to be lucky that the thing that you wanted to write and that you love happens to be really hot in the market right now.
That was lucky. I guess that's
true. Yeah, maybe that's a bonus. I don't know, but you know, that's a very good point. Yeah. We talked last time when we talked about how you started by planning out the book that you wanted to write, and that I think you were on vacation, and your fiance at the time, I think it was, challenged you because you took a book or a stack of books and they didn't connect with you. So he said, well, write something that you would like to read. And so you took that challenge and you spent your vacation kind of planning out what you would write. Yeah. Now that you have book two finished and it's publishing, book three is, I'm assuming, finished or maybe in edits, you know, pretty much done. Are you happy that, first off, did you plan, you know, in that first stage, did you plan that this would be a 3-book series? Could you see that far into the future? Or did you think this would be a really great book, and maybe somewhere in the planning you decided, oh, I need to split this up? Or did you say, there's more to the story I could tell? Like, when did it go from a book idea to, oh, this is a series?
Yeah, that's a good question. I knew when I was, you know, drafting it on that vacation just for myself, or outlining it, that it would be a trilogy, because I just love trilogies. Especially when it comes to romantic tension, I'm always interested in, you know, drawing that out, really getting to know the relationship, building, you know, if it's enemies to lovers, enemies to friends, to enemies again, to lovers. Like, I want to just draw it out, draw it out, the slow burn. And I feel like you can do that best over multiple books. And for me, again, going back to writing what you love, I sometimes don't have the patience or the bandwidth for like a really a multi book series. So trilogy or duology is like, it's tight, it's easy. I know what the read is. So I knew I wanted it to be a trilogy, and I had a pretty good sense of books one and two, because in my mind, I feel like they are kind of two halves of one whole. It's like the end of book one. I not to really spoil it, but at this point I feel like, you know, whatever, it's out. So I feel like I can say some things, but you know, by the end of book one, they've sort of kind of acted on their romantic attraction to one another, but not enough. You know, we haven't really built that relationship. So books one and two, I had a really good sense of all the beats. Book three, I knew how I wanted the series to end. I knew how it would begin. I knew maybe like two plot points, but I really had to, about halfway through writing the second book, sit down and start thinking about what that was going to look like. And it was actually, it was harder to do at that point in time, because obviously I had already, you know, in some ways you paint yourself into a corner, like you set yourself up.
Right.
In the future, I definitely will outline all the books before I go write them, because you know there's, you know, story struggles sometimes with the third one.
Yeah. Promise of Peridot is book two in a series, and you know we talk a lot about the everybody loves to write beginnings. There's so much excitement and setting up a story and, you know, putting little clues in that you'll pay off later and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then everybody loves to write an ending and really land it and stick it and, you know, pull all the twists and all that good stuff. But the middle, a lot of people struggle with that murky middle, the mushy middle, you know, we have all these, you know, terms for it. And it's, for a lot of people, the middle is a slog. Book two, if you think about the trilogy as one giant story, book two is that mushy middle. Because this is a fantastic book and it has an arc all its own. Even though it fits into the greater arc of the trilogy, it is a standalone story in that it has a beginning, middle, and end. And there's excitement, there's resolution, but not too much resolution, because you still want book three. There's still things that need to be resolved. But but this book is a story. How do you approach that? And you know, while knowing that there's still story to tell in book three, the book two has to serve a particular purpose, but it also needs to be a fun read. And did you think too much about that, or, you know, were you just in excitement mode and just plowing through and then, you know, realize, oh, I just did the middle and didn't think about it much.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny because the middle, which I agree can be sort of the hardest part, is also like, you know, it's sort of like sometimes referred to as like the promise of the premise. It's the like, you know, it's the section where whatever you've told your reader the book's going to be about, you actually get to jump into, because the beginning you got to set it up and the end you've, you know, raised the stakes and things have changed. But maybe that first half of the middle can be the most fun part of the book, because, you know, if I tell you, okay, A Dawn of Onyx is a captive romance, she's got to get captured. You got to get that Beauty and the Beast, Hades and Persephone sort of thing going before you get to play with the girl stuck in the Dark Kingdom. If I tell you that, you know, this book is an enemies to lovers, you know, on an adventure, I got to set up why they're enemies and get them on the adventure before I get to have fun and put them in situations where they're fighting, but they got to work together, whatever. So I think in that way, it was just so much fun. It didn't feel like a struggle because I got to do the thing that, you know, I had sort of set out to do. On the other hand, you make a really good point, which is the middle of the entire trilogy is hard. You know, it's hard to maintain the dramatic, the fantasy, and the romantic tension, because you're inclined to start resolving things so people don't feel like your book is just going in circles or your series is going in circles. But like you said, if I resolve too much, there's no need for a third book. So I think that was, I'd say maybe like this, the second half of the book took more thought than the first half. It took me longer to outline and longer to work on and more reworking of the chapters and the edit, because I just wanted to make sure that it was feeling organic and authentic and true to the characters. Like you said, their arcs were completing in natural ways. And I was setting up what I hope is a compelling ending that gets you excited for the third book to finish the series. And that was maybe harder than the first half of the middle, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. From the last time we talked, you had published book one and then signed the deal, republished. And I think we talked a little bit last time about kind of that moment where when you're writing before you publish and this gift of anonymity that no one knows that you have a book coming out. So there's no expectations. There's no pressure from anyone. You're just doing a thing that you love. You're just writing this book and telling the story to yourself. And then, you know, then it finds an audience and then it finds a major publisher and then it sells a bajillion copies. And, you know, there's another book coming. Does that expectation from readers or maybe expectation that you put on yourself? There are contracts that have been signed. You know, there's deadlines now. Does that change your creative process or how you approach the work every day?
Oh, these are all such great questions. In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think the deadlines don't bother me. I happen to have a very type A personality. Like, give me rules and I will follow them. It's how I like to do everything. So I like, you know, I love having a teammate and my editor who is so spectacular and so talented and so bright. I feel so lucky to have her in my corner. And it makes me, I think, a better writer and a more focused writer to know, okay, I got to get this to her by this date. And there's, you know, steps that need to be taken. So that doesn't bother me. I do turn into a gremlin before my deadline. Like I think a lot of authors do. I think it was Leigh Bardugo who was like, I just lock myself in my room and just like accumulate, you know, like snacks and trash, whatever. So like, yes, sure that, you know, maybe that adds a little bit of stress that you have a set time, but that I'm fine with. And the expectations from the reader is, you know, it's such a blessing. Like I feel unbelievably grateful every time I have, you know, a DM or an email or a comment on an Instagram or TikTok saying, you know, we can't wait. And when's the next one? You know, it's like, or they have a theory. I feel so excited to communicate with readers. Anybody who interacts with me on Instagram knows, like, I'll answer anybody. I'll talk through theories. You know, I'll post your stuff. I feel excited all the time that anybody is reading the book. The only thing that I would say is harder outside of the anonymity is, you know, when you're just writing it for yourself, there is no pressure on the success of the book and you can just write the story. And if you're happy with the story, that's sort of all you need. And I think the outside factors, like the pressure to post on social media a lot, to make sure you're marketing your book all the time, to, you know, I think some of the pressure to get the book out there and to market it and to treat it like a commodity can take away from the creative joy. You know, when you're talking to one reader who loved it and or hated it or whatever and wants to talk to you about it or something, any kind of passion, that's the best. But when you're like, go buy my book, it's da-da-da, it's like that, I feel like can be sometimes a little bit soul-sucking because you're like, ugh, I don't know. It's like it can be hard to sort of, I think, treat it like a business. And it is absolutely a business. You know, I have to make money for my publisher. So I think that part can just feel stressful. It can put pressure. You know, you're like, I don't just want this to be good so readers like it and I like it. I want this to be good because it's a product that has to be sold. And I think that can sometimes weigh on me a little bit, but I'm lucky to have made a lot of wonderful author friends who I think have been doing this longer than me, who have given me a lot of good advice when it comes to making sure that your craft still feels like a craft and a hobby and something you love and also a job, if you will.
Yeah. When fantasy literature really started blowing up and kind of crawling out of the Tolkien, you know, kind of world, in the first... I'm trying to say this without being, I'm just going to say it.
Say it.
There are, stereotypes, let's just say, of the typical fantasy reader back in the day, you know, in the 80s, 90s, mostly kind of guys who would play Dungeons and Dragons, probably had Lord of the Rings statues on their shelf, you know, those kind of folks. And this new fantasy romance kind of mixture is having a moment right now. There's big books in the genre that are selling like wildfire, and it's finding all new audiences. And you know, we've said forever that no matter what genre you're reading, you really should read widely, because there's things from other genres that you could pull into your writing that would make your character so much better. You know, there every character can't be a ranger who's out saving the day. You know, there's going to be some romance in life. There's going to be relationships that happen. There's going to be mystery. There's going to be, you know, and all of these things that you could learn from other genres would make your book so much better, so much real, your characters more realized. And we're finally starting to see some of that. And, you know, this kind of romance and fantasy or romantasy, or there's all kind of, you know, little terms people have come up with, is really having a moment right now. What do you think about that, about how fantasy is expanding and you know, pushing the boundaries of what you can write in a story, and you know, because of that, bringing in all sorts of new readers who love fantasy stories, who love these fantastical places and these, you know, larger than life characters, but really wanted to see some more depth to these characters and things that we're finally seeing now. What do you think about the fantasy genre and how you and a lot of your contemporary authors are kind of pushing the envelope a little bit?
Yeah, it has been a really interesting, as you know, as just a reader, it's been such an interesting time in the fantasy space. I was always a big fantasy reader, but actually was not a big romance reader until like college, later in college. I read Twilight like all other middle school girls my age, but right. You know, I only kind of mostly in the pandemic actually got into fantasy romance as like a combo through Sarah Maas, as I think a lot of people did with the success of Four Thorns Roses. Then they went back and read Throne of Glass. Then they sort of expanded from there. I think it's interesting. Actually, my literary agent said this to me about a week or so ago, and I've been thinking about it a lot. I think that it's, in some ways, it's sort of like the resurgence of what had been really popular in YA maybe like a decade or even a little bit longer ago. There was like a period of time where it was like Hunger Games, Divergent, you know, The Selection, Matched, like all of those dystopian, strong female lead. There was like some kind of romantic through line, but it was not like the heart of the story. Challenges, quests, war, battle of good versus evil, but really for like a young female reader POV, because of what you said, that like most fantasy, you know, readers, Game of Thrones readers, Lord of the Rings, Brandon Sanderson, you know, it was Kingkiller Chronicle, like that was a predominantly male audience. And so this was sort of the answer to that for, you know, younger female readers. And I think then, like anything, it's like studying, you know, what movies are successful and looking at sort of theater statistics that changing over the years. I think it was like then the space blew up so much that it became so crowded that, and the readership got older and it sort of there was a shift. And now it's sort of like those same readers are finding Fourth Wing, people who had loved, you know, Hunger Games or whatever, Serpent in the Wings of Night. And it's sort of bringing back that same readership. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think that has to do with sort of like this having a moment again, this like romantic space sort of becoming more and more commercial, more popular. Because even in 2020, you know, 4 years ago when I was reading A Court of Thorns Roses for the first time, none of my girlfriends, you know, had heard of it. They weren't on Book Talk. They were like, "What, you're reading about fairies?" I was like, "I know, don't judge me. It's weird, whatever." Now, like, they've all read Fourth Wing. They're all like, "What are you reading now?" You know, it's like it's so much more. You know, these are New York Times bestsellers. They're much more popular. Not that A Court of Thorns and Roses was A Court of Thorns and Roses wasn't then, but it's growing and growing and growing now.
Right.
And I think also, not to like get on my soapbox, which happens, but I think it speaks to the power of the female dollar. I mean, you look at the success of Barbie, you look at the Eras tour, you know, you look at Beyonce's tour. There has been in the past, you know, year or so, there have been so many, so much media geared towards women audiences that have been so outrageously successful. Colleen Hoover's, right, you know, piece that I believe was in, I don't remember what article it was, but about just like how successful romance as a whole, especially her books, are. And I think it's sort of like a moment of like really focusing on a female readership. And then it's been really exciting to see that those books reach all genders, you know, that actually it's not just women that are reading these books. I mean, my husband has read every fantasy romance that I have. He loves them. So, you know, I think it's been an exciting moment to like watch the genre grow. And I hope that it continues because it's what I love to read and what I love to write. So I hope it sticks
around. That's great. I'm here for it. I hope it continues to expand, and I hope that stories that we tell, you know, take in all of human experience, because that's what we go to books for, is to experience it all. Anyway,
well, what you were saying also about like the genre blending, I think is really exciting to people, maybe because now there's so much content and you can literally at home on your couch, you know, switch from the book on your Kindle to the physical book, to the episode on Peacock, to the thing that's streaming on Netflix, you know, whatever. Right. There's so much content that I think maybe it's exciting to people to feel like I can get my romance and my fantasy in this. This will have mystery. This will have comedy. This will be, you know, I think people want more and more and more. They're more voracious for storytelling and for media and for content in general. So it's exciting to get something and know that it's going to be a hodgepodge and not sort of like one specific thing that is going to check certain boxes. They want to be surprised.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I believe you told me last time that when you first started thinking about this series, that you had a plot idea first and then characters came later. These, you know, now that we've got book two, these characters are really they've taken on lives of their own, and it's almost hard to believe that these characters didn't come first for you. It feels like these were characters that had just lived in your head and you were just looking for a way to bring them to life. It's almost odd that they were, you know, kind of the second thought after the plot. But how do you feel about these characters now? And, what was that experience like of creating characters that would fill this world? And, how do you feel about them now?
Yeah, it's so funny because I agree. I mean, now I think I say this in my acknowledgments of the last book that like they honestly feel so real to me that it's like I don't even like to read their sex scenes, even though I wrote them. I'm like, this is inappropriate. Like these feel like children. Like if there is, I know how crazy that sounds, but there is, you spend so much time, especially with the trilogy, like in the heads of these people, they start to feel really real to you. And so three-dimensional and flawed, and you know, you have their sense of humor, and especially when you're writing two perspectives, you're like, he would say this, she would never say that. Like you know them, like they're real people, like in your friend group or in your life. I think probably like a very, very first draft of A Dawn of Onyx would read so differently from what, you know, is out now, what you can read, because, you know, it was very amateur writing, having never, you know, taken any writing courses or written anything in my life before. It was really plot leading character where I thought, you know, I love when this happens, so I'm going to just make this happen and my characters will show up. And then after drafts and drafts and drafts and drafts and working on it, you know, hopefully that changed. And I think you can see that change even more in the second book, because with the first book, you know, it really was an exercise in like, this is a story that I would want to read. These are the things that happen in the books that I love. And now I have to fill these characters in that will make this organic. And of course that changes over the drafting process. But in the second book, Promise of Peridot, I know these people like the back of my hand, and the book, the outline came from who are these characters? What are they grappling with? What are their emotional and mental and physical journeys that they need to go on? And then you tell that story and there's your plot. You know, it's like the characters really are leading. And whenever there were moments where I'm like, man, I don't know what happens next. It's almost a huge relief because you're like, I'll literally just ask my characters. You know, you think to yourself, like, what would she do in this moment? And there's your answer. And there's a huge amount of relief in that than trying to shoehorn them into a scene you want to happen. I'm not saying it's that easy all the time, obviously, but sometimes that's how it feels. So I think now in the second book and in the third book, you can feel it even more that, you know, as you've gotten to know these characters, so have I, and they become more themselves, and that drives the story, I think, into an even more interesting direction.
Having finished book three now that we'll see later this fall, did the story kind of stick to your original plan you had, or, you know, as Tolkien said, did it grow in the telling?
Oh yeah. It did not stick to, I actually went back just for fun and read the outline that I sent my editor and was like, What was that book? That's a totally different book than the thing that I wrote. It changed quite a bit, and all for the better, I think. The characters definitely grew in certain ways that led to kind of left turns I had been expecting that I think only enriched the story and made it more fun. There were also things, I mean, like characters that I thought would have a certain ending. And as I wrote it, I'm like, this makes no sense. Now that I've written, you know, it's the longest book. It's I think the darkest book. Now that I've written all this stuff, I'm like, I can't end it like that. I have to make these changes. Some that I think are more tragic than I had planned, and some that I think are a little happier than I had planned. So there was a lot in the ending specifically that changed once I had gotten to the end of the book, you know, writing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the characters that we were talking about a minute ago, you know, in a lot of classic fantasy, we see these characters that are just kind of archetypes, you know, the kind of two-dimensional cardboard cutouts of, you know, guys that save the day and, you know, evil wizards and things like that. And your characters are so, so human, so, multifaceted, because you're not afraid to show us not only their noble qualities, but also their anxieties, their hangups, their, the things that scare them. How do you feel about, you know, portraying a whole character and bringing all of that to the story?
Thank you for saying that. That's so kind. It is a little scary sometimes because, again, kind of going back to your earlier question about like the pressure of now, you know, readership and these books being seen by the world, you have to sort of have faith that your readers will be in it for the journey, and they'll know that, you know, as your characters make mistakes and come to the wrong conclusions or act selfishly or naively or impulsively, that they're going to learn, that they're going to grow, that they'll have to grapple with their mistakes. And you hope that people aren't like, wow, that's stupid, and they put the book down on that page where, you know, somebody makes a mistake, whatever. And you have to sort of assume that's going to happen sometimes, because such as, you know, publishing your books. But overall, despite sometimes worrying that I'm painting these characters that I love negatively, I think it's really important to be honest. And when I think about my all-time favorite characters in all, you know, books, film, television, even real life people that I admire and love so much and, you know, aspire to be like, they're all incredibly flawed. You know, I think I can't think of anybody that is a really spectacular fictional character that doesn't have some incredible flaw that they either overcome or they don't. And I hope to, you know, be writing characters like that. That's what I'm striving to do. It's what makes them interesting and human and authentic and readable. And I think especially when it comes, man, I really am on my soapbox today, but especially when it comes to female characters, because you get that so much less often. You know, I'm sure you've heard the term Mary Sue, like, you know, there's always thing about the female character that's like the manic pixie dream girl. You know, it's like there's so many buckets that these characters can fall into, and almost those names in themselves become misogynistic. So it's like, I would like to wipe the slate clean and just write a really authentic character. And, you know, of course she's going to have all kinds of issues because she's human. But I think at the end of the day, it's a refreshing and enjoyable practice, because I think it would be a lot harder to try to write somebody that, you know, I couldn't see myself in, because they were so, you know, heroic or brave or perfect. You know, that doesn't sound very fun to read or to write.
Right. I have one more question that I wanted to ask you, and that's dealing with magic systems, because, you know, it wouldn't be a great fantasy novel if we didn't have some magic involved. Mm-hmm. How do you think about, you know, going to the fantastical elements and thinking about how these things will work? Do you get hung up on the rules of, you know, and the mechanics of things, or, you know, what's your personal thoughts on bringing those elements into a story?
Yeah, I like to start my magic systems like as close to, this is also something that Brandon Sanderson talks about a lot, but like base it off of some kind of real life. Like if you're going to write about, you know, what serves as a religion in your book, you know, looking at studying a certain religion in a certain community or culture or part of the world, if you're going to talk about an army or, you know, a political, you know, caste system or strata or whatever, looking at history or looking at certain regions, I think, you know, trying to root it as much in authentic real life examples, it's the best place, at least for me, to start, because maybe it speaks to my lack of creativity, but it makes it easier to just make sure that these things are feeling authentic. And I think also to look at the ripple effect, you know, like what specific religion is most widely practiced in any given country or city or, you know, area affects what food is sold in most markets. You know, it's like there's always, you know, the texture of it goes into everything. And so trying to think about that can obviously get really big and overwhelming. So I like to keep it as small and as simple as possible. I definitely don't tout myself as like a major world builder. But I get like, I'll have a nugget to start with, like, okay, these people worship stones in place of, you know, gods or deities, or, you know, these certain, you know, witches pull from lineage, but fae pull from, you know, like an internal sort of earth-based light source. And I try to just keep it simple, and then I'll build from that. But I definitely have a problem. I'll make things harder for myself, and my editor will have to be like, you take these three rules out, you'll make your whole life easier. And that's something that I have to check myself with sometimes, because I'll get too excited. I get too many ideas. And then I end up in a situation where it's like, well, that doesn't work because this rule that you set up 3 books ago, you know, so it's a journey. The world building is maybe the hardest part for me, that and the action scenes for sure.
That type A personality manifesting in places you never thought. Yeah.
Oh my God. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Well, Promise of Peridot publishes on April 9th, and that's just over a month from today. If you're listening, we're going to put links in the show notes where you can pre-order it from Amazon, also from Audible. The audiobook for book one was amazing.
They did such a
great job. So I know book two is going to be fantastic as well. Go ahead and get your pre-order in, or if you've got a great local bookstore, go pre-order it from them as well. Support local books. Yeah. Promise of Peridot coming up very soon. Kate Golden, this has been so much fun chatting again. I know you've got a fantastic website where you, you know, kind of collect news and things like that. Where is that the best place for people to follow along online, or are there other places?
Yeah, I think I'm most active on Instagram these days. Okay. You can find me at Kate Golden Author. You can also follow, or you can sign up there or on my website for my newsletter, where I send out one thing a month. I won't crowd your inbox. And there's usually like fun goodies in there, teasers, fan art, all kinds of fun stuff, that a lot of things that you'll only get from the newsletter that I don't post everywhere. And then you can also find me on TikTok. If you're on TikTok, Kate Golden Author, or yes, my website, which is Kate Golden Books. And then I also want to shout out, there's a great Facebook group. I'm actually not a part of it, but they post all kinds of stuff. And sometimes I'll just, you know, I'll reach out to the admins and we'll do special giveaways for people that are on there. Yep. So that's the Kate Golden Fan Club, which is also linked both on my website and on the link in bio in my Instagram.
Nice. All right. We'll link all that up in the show notes to make it easy for folks to find you. Kate, thank you so much for taking time back on the show.
Thank you for having me back again. This is so much fun every time. Thank you for questions.
And we've got to chat again in the fall when book three comes out. Yes.
Oh man, that'll be very exciting.
Absolutely. That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing.
Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.